The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Okay, so I wanted to share today some kind of thoughts and reflections on some of the a portion of the teachings that were offered on a three-week retreat that I just sat. I don't know if some of you may have even been there online. But the theme of the retreat was the Satipatthana Sutta, kind of going over it. And when I first heard that, I thought a little bit, sometimes there can be a sense of, oh, the Satipatthana Sutta again. Of course, it's the foundational text for our tradition, but there can be a feeling like, yes, okay. And I know that some time ago, some of you may have been here for it, Andrea spent a very long time going through in much detail this text. And yet, I find that each time some expression of it is offered with some depth. Oh, and I know also that Gil did it on the 7 a.m. also for fairly recently. But each time there's always something new or some new angle or something that comes forth, not just because, I don't know, the person thought more cleverly than the people before and came up with some new thing, but, you know, we're different each time we hear about it. So, and I think the depth is almost infinite in some of these really profound texts. So, the area I want to focus on is just the middle two of the four establishments of mindfulness and just part of what's taught there. But for those maybe needing a refresher, the Satipatthana Sutta is the text on establishing the quality of mindfulness or awareness in the mind and heart. So sometimes it's translated as the foundations of mindfulness, like there are these, you know, pillars or something that's holding everything up. It's not quite like that. It's more like these are entry points or inroads to helping this quality of mindfulness, of awareness, to come to the fore in the mind and heart. And as we do the practices, you know, sort of intellectually, we might say, who cares or why or, you know, something. But as we do the practices and we start to see what it means for mindfulness to be established in the mind and heart and body, we see the relevance and the importance of what that really means, what that's pointing to. It's like, oh, this experience is what is being drawn forth or pointed to through the, they're sometimes even called exercises in this text, but they're basically ways of directing our attention and ways of not only directing, but how, what we direct to and how we pay attention to our experience. Experience is happening all the time. We've been paying attention to it our whole life in a sense, but maybe it wasn't working so well for us for a few decades. And then, you know, we started to learn, oh, there's actually ways of cultivating a relationship to experience that is freer, or if you prefer the other side, less suffering, less stress, more freedom, more openness, more happiness. So it's sort of amazing how that can come about. So these two foundations or establishments that I want to focus on are the, well, I should name the four. The first is the body, so something that we can all sense into, at least eventually, and often something that's fairly immediately present for us. So that's where it starts. And then the second is called feeling tone, Vedana. And that has to do with our kind of immediate gut level response to what's coming in, not only to the body, but to the sixth sense door of the mind. So it brings that in. And then the third foundation is the citta, the mind, or the state of the mind. And that's kind of how our psyche is at this moment. One teacher translates citta as psyche. I think it's pretty good. It's meant to encompass the qualities of the heart and the mind. It's not just the emotional side. It's not just the thinking side. It's meant to kind of include all of that and probably some other things too, besides just those two dimensions. So it's maybe our psyche, our mind, our mental arena that we experience the world through. And then the fourth foundation are the Dhammas, and those get a bit more, we need a bit more explanation to talk about those. But these middle two, the kind of framework I want to use in talking about these is the sense that this sutta has a structure to it, has an arc, a flow or a way that it can be understood as a whole and not just scattered 13 different things you might do with your mind, but that there's something happening there. Not necessarily that we would like need to start at number one and proceed all the way through and then something by the end, something's going to have happened. I don't know that anybody practices this text that way, although we could, of course. But more that there's this invitation to see it as a whole, and then we can be invited into different portions that seem relevant or helpful for us in the moment. So these middle two, numbers two and three, span the middle of the text. And if we imagine that there's an arc, then it becomes kind of interesting. Arcs have a turning point in them, kind of a balance point, if you will. And these span that side of it. And it turns out that within each of these areas, the feeling tone and the mind, there is a mini arc. There's a beginning and an end to those two. So that's kind of what I want to bring forth. And I'll be reading a few portions of the text. But if you know it already, it'll be familiar. And you don't need to know the whole thing to understand this talk. So this second way of establishing mindfulness is to direct our attention or to notice in awareness what's called the feeling tone, the Vedana. And there are said to be, at a top level, three different things that we might notice about this. One is that things are pleasant. Another is that they could be unpleasant. And the third is that they're neither pleasant nor unpleasant. That seems to span a lot of the space. It's not meant to be three boxes or baskets where each one is totally separate. Very much there are experiences that are somewhere along a spectrum. We would just say, okay, there are ones that are obviously at the pleasant end of the spectrum, and there are ones that are obviously at the unpleasant end, and then there's this middle range. Maybe we would call it pleasant or unpleasant, but maybe we would just say, kind of neither, kind of a mixture, you know. And there's a way that the mind relates to experience at this very gut level. The Buddha noticed that there's a kind of a initial sense in the mind of what an experience is like as it comes in, and that this is important to notice because it has a big determining effect on what happens after that. So, you know, if an experience comes in and we sense it as pleasant, there's a kind of an feeling and maybe a leaning toward that experience. We can notice this. I'm just inviting things that you may see if you observe this dimension. And if there's an unpleasant experience, it's like, we don't like that so much. And so there might be a pulling away or a pushing away or a turning away in some sense. So there's a reaction in the mind that's, you know, more often more on the aversive side. And if it's neither, the mind has a way of liking drama. So if it's neither, we sense not so important, you know, not about me, not concerning to me. There are a lot of neutral experiences. For example, the touch of your clothing on your skin, you're feeling that much of the time, but mostly we don't notice it unless we have the scratchy sweater or the tag bothering us, something. So, you know, it's interesting to become aware of the more neutral experiences at some point and to actually include those in practice. So often when we hear about feeling tone, this is where we get to, you know, it's the, I like to use these kind of animal sounding responses, the ah, the and the eh, you know, that kind of level. We were responding very, almost pre-verbally. But this, it goes on in the text. It says, so we would call, these are called pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, let's say. But then it goes on to say, and the instruction is really just to notice them. You know, we notice that one or the other of these is happening. But then it goes on to say that we should further differentiate these experiences into two different types. So not just pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, but whether it's the word is translated as worldly or carnal, something like that, kind of that contrasted with unworldly or spiritual, maybe. Not of the flesh. Someone teacher translates them as of the flesh and not of the flesh. But I kind of like worldly and unworldly. I think that's not bad, or spiritual and carnal and spiritual. You can choose. I don't think they're really perfect words for this. The Pali words are samisa and near amisa, the word being the central word being amisa, which means, actually, it means bait or raw meat, something like that. It has a sense of, so of the flesh kind of makes sense, but it also has a connotation of being bait of some kind. So that adds a new dimension. So then for each of these dimensions, whatever we want to call them, there's the pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral of those. So we have six feeling tones in all: pleasant worldly, unpleasant worldly, etc., through pleasant, unworldly, unpleasant worldly, unworldly, neutral, unworldly. So why this extra dimension, and how do we sense that? What does that really mean? So we can start to experience that these qualities that are worldly, they're very much have to do with a direct relationship to a sense experience that's coming in. So we see something with our literal eyes and, you know, it looks nice or it doesn't look nice. Or we hear something and it's nice music or the sound of our friend talking or something. And so it's pleasant. Or it's, you know, the jackhammer outside or fingernails on the chalkboard, you know, unpleasant something. So, you know, these are things where we're having a direct response to something that's coming in to a bodily sense. And then there's also a kind of a mental version of this where we have our immediate mental reaction to something happening at one of the bodily sense doors. So, for example, it might be our friend's voice is talking, and in a sense, that's nice sounding, but they're talking about a topic that we don't like, or they say something that we don't agree with, and there's a mental experience of unpleasantness. Oh, I don't like that she just said that. And so that would be another worldly, unpleasant feeling, but coming in through the sixth sense door of the mind. So it's useful to notice that that's a whole category, and that's where a lot of our day is spent. And yet, what is this other one? The Buddha pointed to also that there can be feelings that come through meditation, through the practice of meditation that are arising not through bodily experience, but through the process that we're doing in our mind from meditation. So this is not something that is really obscure. I mean, he's often pointing toward concentration states to be clear in the text, but you know, maybe you've been sitting, you've had the experience of sitting, and for no particular reason, you feel your body relax. You didn't tell it to relax. You didn't notice how lovely the quiet in the house was. But just like this relaxation, a wave goes through, and then there's a feeling of joy in the mind, or ease, or contentment, happiness, delight, something like that. What is that? That's a very pleasant feeling. And it doesn't seem to have a relationship to something happening in the body. That would be an unworldly, pleasant feeling tone. And we know, we can see the difference, especially when there can be times when something actually unpleasant is happening. We have pain in the body. And we're being with it like a good meditator, you know, and we're aware. And suddenly, something in the mind just stops fighting. And there's a sense of ease with the pain. So the pain is worldly unpleasant, but the ease with it is unworldly pleasant in a sense. So we can start to differentiate. The Buddha says it's worth noticing this difference. And putting this extra label on, is this a worldly or an unworldly feeling tone that's happening? And the reason for that is not described in the Satipatthana Sutta, but just for completeness, I'll mention that in other texts it points out that there's a danger in the worldly feeling tones that if we're not mindful of them, they can draw the mind into things that feed the root of greed, hatred, or delusion in the mind. So if we're not mindful of that pain in the knee, the mind can get sucked into, oh, it's terrible, I can't believe this knee pain, you know, it's having, you know, it's going to lead to surgery, and I don't understand why it isn't any better. I've been trying to fiddle with my posture, and I bought that new cushion, and why isn't it working? And if we're mindful of all that, that's okay, but in a sense, but there's a way where we're going to lose it at some point. And then the mind gets caught up, and then it gets agitated, and then it's thinking. And so we're feeding at that point. We're feeding the root of ill will or the root of aversion in the mind. And, you know, that happens. But it's said that these unworldly feeling tones, say we feel the pleasant feeling tone of ease during meditation. Now we can start thinking about that and make it into a worldly object that we, you know, that becomes something that we're attached to. But if it's just being experienced, that feeling tone doesn't lead into greed necessarily, unless we do something to it. So it isn't feeding at that moment this root of greed. There isn't a danger in these unworldly or near amisa feeling tones. And so they're what's called onward leading. They lead the mind down the path. We follow those, stay with those, appreciate and cultivate those kinds of feelings. The mind will develop along the path. So that's useful to know. That's why that distinguishing thing is there. And they're not always pleasant. There are unpleasant feeling tones that come through meditation also. We can learn to distinguish those. So there's this arc in the middle of the feeling tone exercises where there's this additional little tweak between ones that are onward leading and ones that are potentially entangling. So that's useful. The Buddha says that's useful to see. And then we cross over to the third foundation of mindfulness, of the citta, the heart mind, the psyche. And we see the same structure. There are again it looks very simple on the surface. You're just noticing certain things, like the feeling tone. You just notice there is this feeling tone. And in the mind, you notice there is this mind state. That's all you have to do with it at the top level. And there's eight of them, and we won't go over them all in detail, but basically we notice if the mind is affected by greed at this moment or not. If it's affected by hate at this moment or not. If it's affected by delusion or not. And then there's the fourth one, is if it's contracted or if it's scattered, in a sense, that pair. Each of these are pairs. I guess there are eight pairs. Maybe there's 16 things then. And then the four after that are all kind of expanded mind states. I'll get to those in a moment. But these first four are kind of like that worldly feeling tone part. These are the ones that are difficult for the mind, that are challenging, that have the potential to entangle the mind. Is the mind gets entangled in greed, or it gets entangled in hatred or delusion? These are challenges that affected the mind. And then this fourth one is interesting, because they both seem to be negative, right? If it's greed or not greed, we can say, oh, it's a negative and a positive. But this fourth one, is the mind contracted or scattered? It's like, well, which one is better? It's like, neither one is that good. But I've recently understood that these two are meant to kind of summarize what came before, in the sense of when the mind is caught up in greed, hatred, or delusion, it tends to go in two directions. It either gets contracted, stuck on something, and narrow. I think we've all felt this. Or it gets fragmented, scattered. It gets just running around, distracted. Oh my gosh, what am I going to do about that? It's terrible. Oh my gosh, oh, what am I going to do? It's terrible. You know that feeling? So that's the scattered mind state. And so it's kind of a, you know, if we look at the first three and we're really clear when there's greed and when there isn't, when there's hatred and when there isn't, when there's delusion and when there isn't, then it will be obvious to notice, oh, when it has these difficult ones, it's either contracted or it's scattered. That's what happens. So we have this kind of summary of the first half, is these potentially entangling mind states and what happens when they get entangled. That was what I asked during the meditation, is to notice what it's like when your mind gets caught up. And probably you notice it feels contracted in some way or scattered in some way. Just a suggestion. You can check this out in your practice. So we have this arc. And then the second set of four pairs in this foundation is to look at what happens when that's not the case, when the mind is more expanded, when it's not caught up in greed, hatred, or delusion, which was noticed also in the first half. And there we have mind states that are, the translation here says, the person understands an exalted mind as an exalted mind, and an unexalted mind as an unexalted mind. I like to see that as a mind that's refined, or in a state maybe that's experiencing an unworldly feeling tone. So a mind in meditation. So, and then we also have a mind that is surpassed or unsurpassed. So that means it's in its most excellent state or not in its most excellent state. And this is not like a criticism, oh, my mind isn't as excellent as it could be right now. It's more like a sense of, there's this onward leading sense of, this is pretty good. And I do sense that there could be something better. There could be something more relaxed, more easeful, more open, more expanded. And we get that feeling as we get into the concentration states. This is what brings the mind along in concentration states. You know, it's already good if you're, say, in the first jhana. Fine, no problem. That's great. But why would you ever go to the second jhana since it's already completely wholesome to be in the first jhana? Well, it's a sense that there could be something a little bit more, just a little bit calmer, just a little. And so the mind gets drawn along. So this is on, you have this onward leading sense, and that's what this one is pointing to. And then the next pair is a concentrated or an unconcentrated mind, and then a liberated or an unliberated mind. So we notice various qualities of a mind that is in an expanded state, that's in a relatively free state. We're not talking about, like, is my mind completely the mind of the Buddha or not? That'll be clear enough lots of the time. But we're just noticing, is the mind getting into a state of openness, a state where it's responsive, where it's free, where it has access to compassion and wisdom? So this is this arc in the third foundation. We start with noticing more contracted states, the effect, noticing greed, hatred, and delusion, the effect of that on the mind, and getting sensitive to what is it when that's not there. And none of this is saying, and then you've got to move into, you've got to create, you've got to cultivate. This is such an easeful establishment of mindfulness, because it always just says, just notice what state the mind is in. And then we'll start to see that actually the process is of abandoning the unwholesome and bringing in the wholesome is almost, it's non-willful. It's like just noticing a contracted state, the mind wants to find a way to move out of that. Noticing that there's greed, if you really see it and you're not attracted to it and drawn into it, oh yeah, I really do want that piece of pizza. But it would just say, oh, that's greed. Oh, it feels a little tight. My mind has narrowed in to being pizza mind. That's it. And that's not so comfortable. It will naturally find a way to open, to relax. And so we have this back and forth. Contraction, letting go. Getting caught up, letting go. Getting scattered, bringing together. So we start to see how the mind can find its way through all these different pieces. And the kind of arc of this foundation of mindfulness is to help the mind realize that it wants to be free. It really wants that, and that there are useful distinctions that it can see between. There's an enormous amount of confidence can come from exploring these particular dimensions. So it was said quite nicely on the retreat that we do need to make distinctions. I mean, it's not all about just let's open into absolutely everything and that'll be freedom. No, actually, if you open to absolutely everything, you'll see it's not all that appealing. Some of it is and some of it isn't. So instead, what we're doing is we're distinguishing the aspects that are useful from those that are not so useful. And some of the distinctions we make, it's true, are not so helpful. There are all kinds of biases and discriminations that we make that are not helpful, that are harmful to the world, and we see the effect of them all over. But there are useful distinctions that help our spiritual practice and help the world ultimately. And so it was kind of summed up in a light way by if the mind is thinking about ice cream, it's not that we need to distinguish strawberry ice cream from vanilla ice cream. That's not a useful distinction. The useful distinction is attached to ice cream or not. That's the useful distinction. So we need to be refined not only in what the mind looks at, but how it looks at it. And part of the how is making these useful distinctions so that we can traverse the arc from caught up to not caught up, from focus, coming from greed, hatred, and delusion to coming from non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion. That's the useful distinction. And it's not all on us, our poor, burdened, thinking mind, to figure all that out. The heart can make those decisions itself, as if we are in a state of clear awareness. as is established through Satipatthana Sutta. So maybe those are my thoughts for now on these distinctions that are so important in this mind state that we're working with all day, and yet needing to put into a state where it can really be drawn along the path, can be drawn onward leading. So, other reflections from all of you? Questions, comments? Have you seen some of these things in your own mind? About the feeling tones of, have you experienced unworldly feeling tones? Or have you experienced how certain states of mind are contracting, feel narrow? How is that? Yeah, Jan.
It was working on the hindrances and also in my personal life, this feeling of being thwarted all the time came up for me. And I realized that that comes up when I'm attached to things going a particular way.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't so much around the senses, it was around, well, sometimes it was, but and also I noticed that anytime I'm clinging, which attachment is just another form way to say that, in a way, I'm not in the moment.
Right.
So that, because it's going towards what's next. Like there's this constant going towards what next, and then it can't happen. And then there's this thwarting, this
aversion. Okay, this is great. This is really interesting to see.
It's a full body constriction. You know, it's just like a flinch. And it's, when I tuned into it more, it felt so strong, like I was in the vice grip or something. So I don't, in some ways, as I reflected on that more and more, as I know that happens for some folks, it got really unpleasant.
Yeah.
It really intensified.
Yeah, and were you able to kind of stay with that?
Well,
nice grip and unpleasantness for at least a little while?
Yeah, it was a week or two. Of being with that. And then it just kind of shifted yesterday because I don't know how it shifted. I did have a massage, so that might have helped just with the constriction, but something just hit me and everything softened and I feel more in the moment. But I don't think I really worked with that. Because either I'm in this state of everything's okay, kind of, you know, just sort of being and not so reactive, or I go through these times of being really constricted. So I don't know if there's any more to ways to work with that. When I'm in its grip.
Well, first of all, I just want to highlight that this is really good, mindfulness of mind and body and the process of how it works. And it is like that, you know, the mind gets caught up in things for a short time or even a long time sometimes. And our task is really to do just what you did and to feel the different dimensions of that. It's like, okay, there's the constriction, like even bodily, I can feel it in the muscles. And then there's this unpleasant feeling tone that goes with it. And there's a sense of being thwarted because I can feel the wanting of that thing that I'm not getting. And it's like these are all the establishments that the Buddha pointed to. And it's not always easy to stay with that because it's, it's hard, it's unpleasant and so forth. But maybe we can be with it for a little while and then, we'll get distracted or we need to do something else. But then we come back or it comes back again. And it might be days or weeks. Some things take longer even. and then there is a shift. And it's not that we wouldn't, it's not that, like getting a massage is fine. Sometimes that can help. But in the end, the internal shift is what we're looking for, the sense where the mind gives up on something or understands something or releases something. And then the task is still to be mindful of that, to feel like, oh, to feel that return to the sense of contentment, it's okay, knowing full well that since we're not fully awakened, it will again get stuck somewhere. But the awareness is the key to the whole thing, is as much as you can be aware through it as possible.
So I can see the flow of the different states come and go as well. And I don't have to worry about that I'm bypassing my awareness of the attachment and cling because it's going to come back. So
I wouldn't worry. I will definitely come back.
And then I can be aware again of that. And yeah. I don't know really until I feel the thwarting, right? We don't know we were excited about something sometimes until it doesn't.
That's right. Yeah, there's so much that goes on in this field of our mind-body system. We're just trying to see more and more of it so that it can harmonize and go through exactly the process that you've described. I mean, that process is what the Buddha was pointing to. It's the Four Noble Truths. It's, there's something, there's dukkha, there's the realization of that the grasping is at the core of it. There's finding a path to releasing that. That's it. That's the process.
Okay.
And it's not always easy. And our mind is so creative about finding new ways to cling and crave that we keep having, whatever we did last time might not work this time. So, so we can't get the idea that we've got a plan or a pattern that we can always, an algorithm we can always go through, but we can start to have some faith in the process and working with things. And yes, if it gets to be too much or it's taking a long time or whatever, that's, it's okay to turn away. We will get another chance. We're not aiming to just stare at it until it goes away. Like that's a technique that doesn't really work. So it's more this in and out massage of the mind until it finds the way, until it finds its way. And there's so many, so I know it's not always comfortable, but I really want to thank you for sharing that, in that I think it's a very common experience. And also it, I think it's helpful for others to hear that's how it goes. And, the feeling of being thwarted, that's like the heart of our spiritual practice. It's like, I want something and I don't have it and I got to get it, like whatever. Or I don't want something and I can't get rid of it. And how do I, so that's the basic question for humans. And our whole practice can, is an unfolding of that. So,
thank you very much.
Anything else from others? Okay, well, if it feels complete to folks, we could wind up, and I'll just offer a few words of encouragement that, it's really great to see all of us practicing here together, and just know that we're this process of slowly untangling the mind from its tendency to grasp onto things and limit itself is something that's really profound to go through, seeing that and seeing the release of that. Sometimes it can feel very mundane when we realize that what we're really attached to is, I really just want, you know, my neighbor to stop their dog from barking. And it feels like, how mundane, you know, how trivial this is that I'm caught up in this. But this is actually in the process of going through that. And this is just the manifestation of whatever, something. Process of going through that really is deep and profound in the long run. And doing this work is really, I think, the best work in the world, and because it opens our own heart and mind to so much more ease and less suffering, and it makes the mind available to support others in their own freedom, their own path, whatever that looks like, however that is for them. And we become really, truly gifts to the world through this practice, even when it's about very mundane things. So I hope you'll feel encouraged and keep on with the details of your beautiful life. Thanks, everyone. Have a wonderful week. Feel free to unmute and say goodbye.
Thank you, Kim. Goodbye, everybody.
Thank you.